lurked in the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends.
Mike Honig on KPFT HD3. You are listening now to, that was actually Debbie Harry on Call Me. I don't know how much of that we get. HD3 is a new channel on KPFT, and our motto here on Think Wing Radio is that you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. We are live on HD3, and we're live on the Internet at kpft.org. And, of course, you can also listen to the show after the fact on demand. If you're on Twitter, we will take a shot at seeing if I can take comments on hashtag ThinkWing. Do remember, KPFT is now having its spring pledge drive, and you can support ThinkWing Radio and KPFT, your listener-supported station, by calling in a pledge to 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT, and tell them that Mike sent you. Okay, on to today's show. West Texas. Until recently, that just meant the part of Texas on the other side of Midland, Odessa. Now it's become something else entirely. A small town which has experienced disaster, devastation, and tragic heroism. 102 years ago, on March 25th, 1911, another fatal disaster struck. It happened in New York City. A fire broke out on the ninth floor of the building housing the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, killing 146 people, mostly young women, many in their teens. The victims either burned alive or jumped from the top floors of the building to avoid burning alive. What do these two events a century apart have in common, and why did they connect in my mind? My guest today is Ed Sills. He's communications director of the Texas AFL-CIO, a state labor federation of 235,000 affiliated union members who advocate for working families in Texas. He sends out a daily email on union issues for Texas AFL-CIO members and their friends who are interested in labor. If you would like to join Ed's email list, you can email him to ed@texasaflcio.org, and that's Texas without abbreviation, TexasAFLCIO. And now let's see if I can get Ed. Ed, are you there?
Yes, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. I am so pleased to have you, and I'm so glad I was able to get the board to work on that the first time. So, the connections between the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the West Texas disaster. My feeling is that there ought to be a mental connection, a historical connection, because the Triangle Fire was sort of an impetus for the 20th century labor movement. There had been certainly labor movements before. The United States has historically been uncommonly resistant to union movements or collective bargaining or really any kind of worker input to management and ownership. I think, to me, the West Texas example, the West Fertilizer Company example, I should say, to make it a little more clear, is one of those, should be one of those symbolic events that tells us that low regulation, excessive deregulation, business libertarianism, these things come with their own problems and human costs.
Absolutely. The issue in both of those tragedies and in other tragedies that we've seen recently is the lack of prevention. If you look at the West Fertilizer Company, it came out almost immediately that the company, for example, didn't have a sprinkler system. The company had not reported the chemicals it had to Homeland Security. There were any number of issues that had arisen at the times the company did get inspected by federal agencies.
And that was fairly infrequent.
That was infrequent. And when it came down to it, There wasn't any kind of unified effort to make sure that the company was taking every precaution they could take in the event of a fire. And we saw what happened.
I think it's worth noting that, you know, of course, the investigation is still underway. We don't really know all of the things that contributed to this disaster, but there are some things that either we know or seem clearly indicated. You mentioned the lack of fire suppression equipment, which seems to me like sort of a no-brainer if you're going to be using hazardous chemicals. There had already been recorded violations of reporting rules to the Department of Homeland Security because ammonium nitrate is not only used for fertilizer but for bombs. There had been a history of break-ins going on for at least 7 years, possibly because of people stealing chemicals necessary to make methamphetamines, but we don't know. And then, of course, there's the broader aspect of not only the workers who were endangered. I mean, it was just dumb luck that really, I think that there was one worker who was killed, a manager. He was killed as a first responder, not in his capacity as a worker at the plant. But they were jeopardizing this whole community. I mean, this was, at the minimum, they have admitted to having probably at least 50 tons of explosive ammonium nitrate on the premises, which I think that the what's the reporting limit? I think like something over 450 pounds. They're supposed to report this overage, and I guess that gets them into a whole different inspection class.
I'm not aware of what the limit is, but I do remember reading that it is much lower than 40 or 50 tons, whatever they actually had there. It should be possible to have a plant that is covered for most any scenario that it can come that you would expect to come up with. You can't always prepare for the unexpected. The problem here was that the company seems to have erred on the side of low cost and wasn't really doing much of anything to prepare for however it comes out, whether it was an accident or whether it was something deliberate. And ironically, there was an announcement that they're going to tell us what the cause was sometime tomorrow. So we're on the eve of knowing a lot more about what happened.
Yeah, that should be really interesting. You know, one of the reasons I have you on as a guest is because this kind of thing, workplace safety, worker safety, has always been an important pillar of the reasons for union organizing, the raison d'etre, if you will, of unions. I mean, unions didn't start out in, say, the 18th or 19th century demanding higher wages and medical insurance. What they were demanding was that we not be sent into mines that you have not made a reasonable effort to keep safe, or that we not be forced to use machinery that puts us at serious risk of losing limbs or life. Can you tell us a little bit about that background, to your knowledge?
Absolutely. It seems like a very basic labor right that when you go to an office or a plant or wherever your workplace happens to be, that you have an all but certain chance of coming home at night as healthy as when you went to work. This fight, I'm glad you brought up the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, because that was for a long time the symbol in American history of what happens when nothing is done to protect workers. There was actually some evidence that management had locked doors and made it even worse for workers if a fire should break out, and that's exactly what happened. The workers, in some cases, ended up throwing themselves out of a window rather than get burned.
If you can call it such a thing, the Triangle Shirtwaist fire was like a comedy of catastrophe. You had what appeared to be locked or obstructed doors to keep people in so they wouldn't steal, is what has sometimes been given as the rationale. The fire ladders were only able to reach up to the sixth floor, so people that were waiting for rescue were unable to escape that way. I think I have read that also because of the physical conditions of the plant, the fact that it was a garment factory and there was a lot of lint and a lot of stray material around, it really was a tinderbox. And I think that from my reading, there had been already numerous complaints and a couple of maybe potential incidents prior to this catastrophic one at that very factory. Am I remembering that correctly?
I believe that's right. I don't think that the regulatory environment was up to doing anything about it at the time, although every time you have one of these tragedies, or I should say most times, because West may be the exception, but most every time you have a major tragedy like this, legislatures reexamine what the laws are. Regulatory agencies will go over what they did and what they can do. And I think we will see that in the West fertilizer case. We just won't see any likely action from the legislature.
I think that one of the things that has occurred to me, and we discussed it in our pre-interview, is I think one of the things that made the Triangle fire so impactful on subsequent events and subsequent history is that there were photographs of the victims. There were photographs of the building surrounded by the bodies of young women who had died jumping from the building. There were pictures of loved ones going to the makeshift morgue in order to try to find their relatives. Those pictures are horrific and terrible and sad. But I think that in recent years, in the interests of consideration of feelings or consideration of sensitive viewers or listeners, I think without those pictures, these things become less real and less disastrous. You know, not to veer too far off the subject, but when you talk about shooting deaths, when you don't see the bodies of the kids or the civilians that have been shot and killed, it makes the issue more esoteric and less real. And I think that at something like West, you know, the fact is we didn't see the bodies, and you can argue that that's the decent, sensitive thing to do, but it may also impede progress towards safety so that fewer people have to face that prospect in the future.
There may be something to that on some of these accidents. In the case of West, it's possible that just seeing the landscape after the explosion was visually stunning. It was on television for a long time, and I think that there has also been some notice taken of the human cost. You know, in our own case, we had a beloved 30-year veteran of the Dallas Fire Department who happened to live in West, and he wasn't on duty at the time the fire broke out, but when the alarm went off, he ran over there to help the volunteer firefighters. He did everything he could up to the last minute. His name is Kenny Harris. And just thinking about the level of bravery that it takes for those volunteer firefighters and for Kenny Harris to have fought that thing, knowing the contents of that facility, it's awe-inspiring to me that they would go do that. I think these kinds of stories
Kenny survive?
Place of the visuals for a lot of people.
Did Kenny survive that?
There was a very significant emotional impact.
I'm sorry, did Kenny survive that?
No, he did not.
Oh, my God.
He was one of the victims of the explosion.
Sorry.
And he and I believe it was a total of 10 firefighters out of the victims. What an extraordinary act of bravery, but we see this among first responders all the time. They don't always know what they're facing. They go into extraordinarily dangerous conditions, and they're often the subject of labor disputes with politicians, but
who run the other way when they're faced with, you know, risky things. I have to do a quick station ID. This is KPFT HD3. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. My topic today is worker safety in the 21st century, and my guest is Ed Sills, Communications Director of the Texas AFL-CIO. You can get on his mailing list that discusses union issues, that it's available to AFL-CIO members and friends who are interested in labor, and you can join that list by writing to ed@texasaflcio.org. Ed, after our discussion last night, or yesterday afternoon rather, I had done some additional work, and it had occurred to me that there was another disastrous ammonium nitrate explosion in Texas, and actually West occurred one day after the 66-year anniversary of that one. That was the Texas City explosion. Now, there we're talking about 2,300 tons of ammonium nitrate compared to the 50 tons at West. It was, I think it's still considered the largest non-nuclear explosion that has ever occurred. And even the West, I read that the West explosion rated, I think, a 2.2 on the Richter scale. So it was like a small earthquake. It's like, haven't we learned anything about care around these things and the necessity for the safety of working conditions, not only for workers, but for the communities surrounding workplaces?
I think when you look at the state of Texas, in a tragedy like this, you're not looking at malfeasance like you saw with the Triangle Shirtwaist fire. It's more like nonfeasance. It's a deep-seated belief that government regulation should be avoided, and that keeping the cost of doing business down should be the top priority.
To what extent are Texans putting their lives where their mouths are?
Well, if you look at the West tragedy, it's obvious that there is a price being paid, although maybe not by the same people who hold those views.
Yeah.
But I would argue that I understand the imperative for business owners to cut costs. But I would argue that anyone who suffers a tragedy such as this one would give anything to go back and see what they might have done to prevent it.
I can't believe that this level of destruction from a strictly economic standpoint can be a good thing for a company. It's like, you know, deferred maintenance. It costs a little to get it done. It costs so much more to repair the damage for not having done it. So even on an economic level, I think that it raises questions. We had discussed also a New York Times article, and I have a quote here that Texas, and by the way, I have a link to this on my website at thinkwingradio.com. Texas has had the nation's highest number of workplace fatalities, more than 400 annually for much of the past decade. Fires and explosions at Texas's more than 1,300 chemical and industrial plants have cost as much in property damage as in all the other states combined for the 5 years ending in May 2012. Now, that seems to me like, aside from the human cost, just bad business.
It certainly seems like bad business to me. Certainly, when people decide on where to live, when they decide on what communities to choose, if they're worried that a plant that could be in their neighborhood might blow, it's going to have a significant economic effect.
Maybe we need warnings on chemical plants like we have on cigarettes, because people that live near these things often don't know the risk they're running. In the case of West Fertilizer, they were underreporting, so people literally could have made an informed decision about the risk and just been totally wrong.
That's true. And what we've found out after the explosion is that there are a fair number of communities in Texas that have similar facilities. For security reasons, you know, nobody's drawing the map exactly, but it seems like there are between 3 and 4 dozen similar facilities dotting the state.
Getting back to the Triangle fire, actually, that had, I guess what you might call, a trickle-down effect on labor law history. You had told me that Francis Perkins, who was FDR's Secretary of Labor, had actually been a witness to that fire in 1911, and that had sort of a lasting impact on her and how she viewed labor and business and worker safety.
Well, Francis Perkins, who was the first woman to head a cabinet department, was very well known already for working on wage and hour issues when the Triangle Shirtwaist fire occurred. She happened to be an eyewitness to it, and it affected her so deeply that she expanded her repertoire and got heavily involved in workplace safety issues. Ultimately, she became a major player in all things labor, And she was one of the most significant figures in Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet. She was one of only two to be with Roosevelt throughout his presidency, which, you know, was more than three terms. And she had a very significant impact on all of our lives. She was one of the architects of Social Security. She was involved in many other aspects of the New Deal. And she may be one of the lesser known great women in American history, but she was a great labor leader who ironically was involved in the Triangle Shirtwaist fire as part of her education, I guess you could say.
And the horror of that actually informed her views on the positive roles that government can play as she moved up into positions of influence.
Absolutely. And one thing we didn't mention when we spoke about this, Franklin Roosevelt is known for having advanced the labor laws, and there are many people trying to overturn some of those laws even as we speak. But the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which is the primary federal law for inspection of workplaces for safety issues, was signed into law by Richard Nixon.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony that every Republican president seems to make the last one look so good.
Well,
of course, yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is it should be a bipartisan issue.
It should be.
There shouldn't be any partisanship over whether workers are going to be safe and able to come home to their families.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of interesting political history here that we don't really want to digress into, but I mean, the fact is that Dwight Eisenhower was actually pro-union. It's just one of those interesting aspects of history that these days seems almost inconceivable. Going back to the worker safety aspect, the value of unions and collective bargaining and organizing, not for wages, not for benefits, not for paid holidays, but just for survival and health and safety. You know, I think an interesting example is going now to the two disasters that have made American news in Bangladesh. There was first the building fire that cost about 377 lives, and then you've got the building collapse, which is now over 1,100. So just in these two incidents within, a couple, 3 months of each other, you've got 1,500 people died because of various safety problems, construction deficiencies, and it's like, what is a job worth? On the one hand, you've got a poor developing country, let's say equivalent to the United States in the mid or late 19th century, when a lot of people were on subsistence incomes. The argument has been made that the women that worked at these factories, even with the low wages they were getting, were doing so much better than the majority of Bangladeshis, especially Bangladeshi women. But then you kind of get to, if I may use a phrase that I'm not sure this is the proper place to put it, but you know, it's like, you can pay us crap, but don't we have a right to survive? Don't we have a right to go home safe? And I think that Bangladesh is an example of, or can be seen as an example of, just how endangered employees can be when either there is insufficient oversight, or the oversight is not followed or not funded. I mean, there are parallels to that in the U.S. Essentially, when you've got politicians trying to roll back the clock on things like OSHA and labor relations, I mean, this is what we kind of have to look toward as a worst-case scenario, in, even in this country. What would you say?
I think that whenever there's neglect in terms of workplace safety, you can have a disaster. I think the Bangladesh building collapse, which is already the worst in the history of the garment industry, was exacerbated by management behavior that is totally inexcusable. When cracks were forming in the building, the reports are that the managers got out and ordered the workers to stay. To me, that's criminal activity. It goes even beyond the workplace safety issues. This disaster was so atrocious that the Bangladeshi government has already raised the wages of garment workers and has changed the rules for organizing into unions so that they no longer require the approval of management in order to form a union.
That's interesting.
This is an atrocious disaster. And what you said is absolutely right. The right to come home from your workplace in one piece is a universal right. You mentioned workers on subsistence wages, and I tend to look at that in two different ways. Probably the most important way is to put yourself in the worker's shoes. From a trade standpoint, we complain about the race to the bottom, and there's ample reason to do that. But from the standpoint of Bangladesh workers, this is how they're going to put food on the table for their families. And I understand the need to work at a job that even might be paying pennies an hour. However, that doesn't excuse the kind of management behavior that made these lives into something that didn't count to them. There's just no excuse for that.
You're listening to KPFT HD3 Radio. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. We're discussing workplace safety in the 21st century. My guest is Ed Sills, Communications Director of the Texas AFL-CIO. If you're listening and you'd like to tweet a comment, I think I could get it if you tweet to hashtag ThinkWing. I think, one of the aspects here is there are dangerous jobs in this country. I mean, if you're on a high-rise building washing windows from a scaffold 50 floors up, or if you're doing high-tension wire work way up on these towers, those are jobs that you go into knowing that they're dangerous, hopefully being paid commensurate to the risk, and you are given the opportunity to make a value judgment. Is this something I want to do? Is this a level of danger that I want to experience? And does this money make it worthwhile? And I think when you're talking about your average worker, these are not choices they're able to make. And I think that's where, even as a free enterpriser, you should have a problem. If you're going to believe in free enterprise and the right to make informed choices, many of these workers who are working in these unsafe places really don't have informed choices, or to the extent that they make an informed choice, it's an informed choice of desperation. They need to have a roof over their heads and food on their tables.
Well, an employer should be required, at the very least, to spend what it takes to make the workplace reasonably safe. The jobs you just described are of long standing, and they have best practices that are well known within the industry for maintaining safety. There's no reason a window washer should ever be injured on the job, because we know what it takes to keep them harnessed properly and all the steps they need to take to follow the rules. Now, mine workers start going into that area where you may not be able to anticipate every collapse, but what you can do is have emergency procedures and other precautions that make it less likely that unexpected events will lead to fatalities.
And I'm going to ask you a leading question. What were the origins of most of those rules and best practices that keep miners safer today than they were 100 years ago?
Well, labor unions were in large part responsible for those rules and the laws that pertain to workplace safety, along with a lot of other things that are taken for granted in the workplace. There were successive labor movements. It wasn't only the AFL-CIO in its current form only began in the 1950s. There have been a succession of labor organizations going back to the 1800s that fought for generations, and usually lost, except it was one of those, I don't know what the opposite of a Pyrrhic victory is, it was one of those losses that leads to victory in the long run, because they kept issues alive for generations and finally were able to get things done.
It literally was a case of, it may not benefit you or your children, but it might benefit your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren. And boy, that intergenerational persistence, that's almost unimaginable when you think of it in the spans of human lifetimes. You know, how long that fight, those kinds of fights go on. And the momentum can seem so incremental, and yet it's there. And it takes really a powerful drive to persist in the face of such obstruction in so many areas, including things like organizing and safety. You know, one of the things that we talked about the other day was that unions today are facing a special dilemma. You've gone from the 1950s, which was probably the peak of union membership in this country. I think you said it was something like 35% of workers at that time. And now I think it's down to something like 17%.
In that range, yeah.
And unions are still active for the betterment of workers, both unionized and non-unionized. They are always on a national and local basis, they're always trying to improve work conditions and to some extent, improve benefits, improve pay, protect workers' rights. And that becomes increasingly difficult for unions as their membership declines. I mean, it's a nonprofit organization, but on some level, it can't always be an altruistic organization. You can't be defending people's rights and then have no source of income in order to perform this kind of activist activity. What do the unions see as their future in terms of the survival of the labor movement in perhaps some newer form? It's gotten so difficult to organize now. There's so much anti-union sentiment that's been created through the last couple, three decades of, I'm going to use the term advisedly, political propaganda. What does the union movement see as its future direction?
There's some exciting thinking going on at the National AFL-CIO, and I think it's gone beyond the thinking stage at this point and is moving into implementation. Through all the time that we've seen the percentage of workers in unions drop, the polls have been fairly consistent that something like a third to 40% of workers, if given the opportunity, would join a union. But the way the labor laws are set up right now, getting that opportunity is very difficult, and carrying it through to an actual contract is extremely difficult. That's a large part of the reason that we've lost membership. Another major part of losing membership is that the economy has changed so much and so much work has been outsourced. But that's a different issue. The thinking that's going on at the AFL-CIO right now is that we need to get away from exclusively thinking about traditional organizing, where you go to each workplace, you try to get a majority to sign up with the union, and then you have usually a contested election to try to get a collective bargaining agreement with management. Instead, the union movement is now looking to other forms of organizing. For example, there's an organization called Working America, where anyone who believes in in improving workplace conditions can sign up and be part of the labor movement. And then we're also seeing some non-traditional unions. A recent one in Texas that just got chartered is the Taxi Drivers Association of Austin. And those drivers are organizing in other cities as well. They're all independent contractors. You know, traditionally, independent contractors cannot get a collectively bargained contract. But what they can do is, because they're a regulated industry, they can work at the city council level to try to improve their working conditions. You know, the thing that matters with workers is not necessarily the contract. The contract is the gold standard, but what really matters is the solidarity. And any group of workers that can stand up and take collective action can be effective in different ways. And we see that all the time with public employees. Most public employees in Texas do not have collective bargaining, but they can work together to persuade elected officials to improve their working conditions. And that's what we see all the time, and we're seeing it right now at the Texas legislature.
Organizations like Working America and the New Taxi Drivers Association in Austin, to what extent is this an adaptive strategy because other areas of law and regulation have made organizing so hard? What are the obstacles that have been placed in the way of organizing that didn't used to exist? And to the extent maybe you can comment on it, the political path that has gotten us there.
I would say, you know, you touched on something when you mentioned that President Eisenhower was generally pro-union. I think the thing that's changed, the law is basically the same. You know, it's had a few alterations over time. But what's really changed is the way management treats labor organizing. There have always been managers who fought unions tooth and nail. And, you know, that's a major part of labor history. But if you go back to the 50s and 60s, by and large, if there was an organizing campaign and the workers had the majority, management understood that, you know, they were going to have to bargain with a labor union. The big companies factored that into their business plan. And in many, if not most cases, the labor unions and management had a symbiotic relationship. You know, labor was able to help management become more efficient in many ways because there was a lot of expertise in those workers. Management understood that the only downside from their perspective was that it might cost them a little more to have a collectively bargained contract. But they would get something in return for that extra cost. I think things are different now. There's more of an orthodoxy among management that unions are to be avoided at all costs.
And that's sort of a contemporary capitalist meme in this country now, is that management and owners and corporate leaders, on some level, they now see workers as one of their raw materials. They don't see a benefit to communicating with workers. Workers seem to be adversaries. Can we talk a little bit more about, if you can, some concrete examples, perhaps, of where a union management cooperative relationship had actually benefited both?
Well, in Texas, probably one of the best examples of that might be AT&T. There's a long tradition of AT&T and the Communications Workers of America working together in the interests of the company. When AT&T has gone to the Texas legislature, for example, on regulatory issues, traditionally CWA has supported them. And CWA can bring some legislators into the equation that maybe management is not able to bring in.
CWA would be Communications Workers of America.
That's right. That would be one example. I think by and large in most places, although we've seen some counterexamples, public employee unions do work with the governing bodies on a close basis to improve the product that government is trying to provide. I know that will sound wrong to some people who may not like government, but there is that kind of relationship in many cases. There are some companies that have an adversarial relationship with their unions, but usually after a first contract or at least a couple of contracts has been signed, that relationship ends up being more of a problem-solving one. There will always be tough negotiations because each side is trying to maximize their piece of the pie.
I think,
but that's not all that unions are about.
Right. I'm going to do a quick station ID. You're listening to KPFT HD3. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. We are talking to Ed Sills, the communications director of the Texas AFL-CIO. The topic is worker safety in the 21st century. And you can get on Ed's email list about labor issues, whether you're a union member or just an interested party, by writing to ed@texasaflcio.org. Right to work has become a popular mantra among many conservatives, and of course there are many of us who think that right to work is a misnomer. How are unions responding strategically and tactically to states that either have right to work laws or have legislatures which are trying to enact them?
Well, we fight them with everything we can, because we see right to work laws as nothing other than an attack on labor unions. But it's more than just an attack on unions. It's an attack on our basic concepts of democracy. If you go and vote in an election, and one candidate wins, and say that candidate was the candidate who wanted to cut budgets, well, you and I might not agree with that candidate, and we may have lost the election, but we submit to that governance. That's the American system. That's democracy. When a vote takes place on having a labor union in a workplace, majority rules, and in most states, that means that everybody is subject to the labor agreement, and everybody will pay dues because the majority voted to do that. Everybody will get the benefit of the labor union also. But in a right-to-work state, what happens is that people are able to opt out of paying dues. So even though a majority in an election that's duly constituted by federal law voted for the union, there are a number of workers who choose not to join in a right to work state, and even in that situation, the union still has to represent those workers. If they have a grievance, they are entitled to union representation, and the union cannot say no to that in a right to work state. So one of the terms that gets applied to that is that they're free riders.
Yeah,
and
the fairness of what is called a closed shop, where when you come in, if there is a union, you sign up with the union, and that way you are helping to support the benefits that you get as well as everybody else. And I guess you also can look at it as a form of cost sharing, where by spreading the cost out among employees, it could reasonably lead to lower dues all around, because the union gets adequate support from more people paying lower dues.
That could be part of it, but one way of looking at it is if you look at the statistics, union workplaces are going to provide higher pay and benefits than non-union workplaces in the same job categories. So I don't think I've ever seen a union contract where the dues were more costly than the benefit that you receive.
I think that becomes a key question in the mind of many people when they hear about unions, think about unions, are faced with the prospect of unions. And I think that it's an argument that employers make. It's like, well, you're going to be paying these dues. What benefits are you going to get that are going to allow you to do more than break even? And there is a local organizer in town that I've chatted with a couple of times. And, for example, about the janitor's strike that they had here in Houston, he made the point, well, there was a pay increase, and to some extent, the dues that they now pay joining the union ate up most of the pay increase. But, on the other hand, in addition to simple pay, they also got improvements in working conditions, they got some sick time, they got some vacation time. So, there are intangible or less tangible ways that actually are money issues that don't look like money issues because, oh, you know, I got a $5 pay increase and I'm paying $4.50 to the union. How did I get ahead? Well, you got ahead because the workplace rules improved and now you've got sick days and now you've got vacation days and you don't feel those, but they're real costs and real benefits.
Absolutely. In any union negotiation, those factors are costed out. If you're asking, if the union is asking for one more paid holiday, management knows exactly what that's going to cost. All these benefits have value attached to them, and workplace safety, you wouldn't cost it out the same way. But as we've discussed, you would consider it to be an absolute fundamental of being in a workplace.
It has a real cost, but it also has a real benefit, and it also becomes an issue of fairness.
Yeah. Now, as workers, you and I wouldn't ever separate out. You know, this is what it costs for me to be able to go home at night, not having been killed in the workplace.
Right.
It's a different kind of benefit.
Exactly.
It's what I would think would be an absolute requirement to open up a business.
But it's not always.
Unfortunately, no.
You know, over the decades since the Second World War, we have heard a lot about the nuclear triad, the fact that we have land-based missiles, air-based weapons, and sea-based missiles. And the theory behind that is that this dynamic allows at least survival of one of those aspects. So you've got what I might call in this context almost a dynamic tension. It creates indecision on the part of potential enemies. You hear people talk about in finance, in public finance, you've got the government model, the business model, and the household model. And those are not the same thing. You can't compare government to either of those. They're different. And I think in labor, you also have a triad of sorts that need to be kept in dynamic tension, and that is the rights and necessities of the business community, the rights and necessities of the labor community, and the legal role and the administrative role that the government plays in this. And I think that there's always going to be some messy back and forth because, you know, you look back in history, government doesn't have clean hands with labor, business doesn't have clean hands with labor, and sometimes even labor doesn't have clean hands with labor. But there is this messy dynamic tension that I think is essential for the system to work properly and fairly for all parties concerned. So business people can make money, so labor people can make a decent living in a safe working environment, and government has a role in helping to facilitate that.
I think you make an excellent point there. One way we've been talking about that point is to ask the question, what would happen if there were no labor unions? It's easy to imagine what would happen if there was no government. We'd have anarchy. And it's easy to imagine what would happen if there was no business. You know, we would have a horrible economy. But, you know, sometimes people need to take a beat or two to think about what labor has done for this country. And if the benefits that labor has achieved were to start disappearing, then workers would notice it very quickly, even though they may take some of those benefits for granted right now.
Charles Dickens would start to look really, really familiar in terms of the conditions he described.
I think that's right.
He didn't make that stuff up out of whole cloth. That was the way people lived and worked in Britain in the mid-19th century, and trade unions were weak, and that was a reason for that. Let's see. I guess one thing that's kind of semi-related to this, and we only have a couple of minutes, so this gives me a good excuse to kind of wrap up a little. There was a cartoon that was published, a political cartoon, that was published in the Sacramento Bee a few weeks ago. And I have this cartoon on my website relating to this particular show, thinkwingradio.com. And on the left, it shows Rick Perry touting low regulation, low taxes, come do business in Texas. And on the right side of the cartoon, it shows the devastation in West. Rick Perry, apparently, and other people in government, I'm going to presume mainly Republicans, were very offended by this cartoon. It seemed completely in bad taste, totally disreputable. And, you know, my attitude, if I can use a little language, it's like it's always a bitch when you got no one to blame but yourself. I mean, this is what he touts. This is what he advertises about Texas. Low regulations, weak rules, low taxes, come do business in Texas. Thought?
It was probably no less offensive to Californians when he went there and tried to take business away.
Well, there's that. There may have been an aspect of that in there.
That was a classic cartoon, in that it was tough commentary, no question about it.
It's amazing how much you can say in how few words.
Yes.
I think we're about done with the show for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. My guest has been Ed Sills. Ed is the, and I have to find my place here, the communications director of the Texas AFL-CIO, the State Labor Federation advocating for working families in Texas, and I might add working families whether or not those families belong to unions. He sends out a daily email on union issues for members of the Texas AFL-CIO, as well as friends of labor, people who are interested in labor. And you can get on that email list by writing to ed@texasaflcio.org. I, of course, have a website, thinkwingradio.com, and I have a lot of links to various aspects of the story that we discussed today. I would also point out that you can go to the TexasAFLCIO.org website and get a lot of information and links there. I very much appreciate, Ed, that you took the time to be on the show today, and I think we've had a useful discussion, and I hope you've enjoyed it and felt it was helpful.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I think there aren't a lot of outlets for labor history out there, and this show does an excellent job of raising issues that need to be discussed.
Well, I appreciate that. I like to think of my role here as inform and discuss, and, you know, I do advocacy and take sides, but mostly I try to be fair-minded about this stuff. And I really think that unions have gotten a bad shake in the last couple of decades, and we really need to rectify that to get that social dynamic tension back in action. Thank you so much, Ed. I'll be talking with you, and hope to have you on the show again sometime.
Thank you.
All right, take care. All right. We have been talking to Ed Sills, Texas AFL-CIO. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT HD3. Remember that KPFT is having its pledge drive. You can support this show and KPFT, listener-supported radio, by calling 713-526-5738. That's also 713-526-KPFT. And we'll be looking forward to talking to you again next week. So have a good time. Have a great week and a great weekend. Thanks for being with us. And remember, slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea. It's the law.
The world stories as they happen here on the BBC World Service. Whether it's news, business, science, art, or sport. Whenever and wherever it's happening, you can hear about it here on the BBC World Service, the world's radio station.